Maybe you remember Steve Martin at the peak of his stand-up comedy career. One of his major jokes and album titles was, "Let's Get Small." Today's guest has done just that, not with her body, but with her house. Dee Williams is one of the major proponents of the tiny house movement. We're talking real stick-built houses, small enough to be built on trailers and towed from place to place. Dee Williams' book is The Big Tiny, a built-it-myself memoir. Call her a teacher and sustainability advocate. She does. She's the co-owner of Portland Alternative Dwellings. If her story sounds familiar, she has been profiled and featured everywhere from Good Morning America to Der Spiegel. Dee Williams, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, it's great to be here, and I do feel very, very small.
Yeah, you have gotten small. I'm going to measure you, is what the cop said to Steve Martin's character. So let's measure. The main floor of your house is 84 square feet, not 184, not 8,400, 84 square feet, not a typo.
That's right. That's right. It's about 11 and a half feet long and about 7 feet wide.
Wow. And you mentioned that this is the main floor of your house. What do you mean by the main floor? How can that be? I mean, these houses are so tiny.
Well, I have a sleeping loft up above, so it adds an extra 49 square feet, but they don't count it for some reason because I can't stand up. I can kneel walk across the bed, but I can't stand up, so they don't count it.
All right. So you hoist yourself into the loft at night, but you also have a dog involved here as well. Tell us about that procedure.
Oh, so at night, I carry her up, and I feel a little bit like a T-Rex, you know, like my arms get exponentially smaller as I carry her up the ladder. But, you know, over time, we figured out a way for me to do it without breaking my back. And then in the morning, I feel a little bit like a firefighter rescuing a small barn animal, and I carry her down.
Do you do a fireman's carry over your shoulders with the dog?
She does. Actually, she does. Yeah, her front paws kind of go over my shoulder, and then I just kind of grab her butt.
So, Dee, walk us around here. What's in your tiny house?
Well, so it's a couple feet off the ground because it's built on wheels. So you take a couple steps up onto the front porch, and the head of my bed is essentially over the porch. So it juts out and creates this little porch roof. You open the front door and step into the house, and I've got my kitchen to the left. It's a very simple kitchen with a sink and one burner stove. And then to your right, across from the kitchen, is the bathroom, which is essentially just a toilet. I don't have running water, so I don't have a shower and stuff like that. Take another step, and you're at my closet, which is a little bigger than like a high school gym locker, but it holds all my tchotchkes, all my clothes. And in the bottom half of that closet, I have the batteries and the inverter and stuff like that for this solar electric system that I have. You take one more step, and you're out from under the sleeping loft in this big room that's about a 7 by 7 foot room, but it's got an 11-foot ceiling and a skylight, so it really feels expansive. It feels really good.
All right, but the expansive in the sense that it is vertical more than horizontal.
Yeah, and it's funny. It's like a little trick on your brain because the you know, as you're walking under the loft, it's about 6'3", and then when you pop out from underneath that and you're standing in this room, it really does do this little brain chemistry thing where it's like, oh, I'm in a massive cave. I'm huge.
So, Dee, I mean, given the lack of room in here, and you talked about the closet, the tchotchkes you keep in there, do you keep anything in storage away from the tiny house?
I do. I have a bunch of woodworking tools that I keep in my friend's garage nearby.
Let's talk about you historically. I mean, I don't know if you have any history with even mild claustrophobia or anything, but if somebody had told you as you entered your adult years, you're going to be living in a house that's about 7 by 12 someday, what would you have said back?
I hope it feels good. I mean, that's the funny thing. It's a small space as far as, you know, if we measure it in square footage, but If I felt claustrophobic, I wouldn't stay there. You know, I don't like closed spaces. Like, you know, I have friends that do caving, you know, spelunking, and I could never go with them. I hate it. You know, so if it felt squishy in there, I wouldn't be able to live there. And you know, I grew up, you know, building tree houses with my brothers and making. I grew up on a farm, so we'd make, you know, forts out of the hay bales and. I definitely like that kind of unique, fun space, and I'm an outdoor girl, so I love backpacking and stuff like that. But, you know, as far as, like, a regular life goes, if it was anything other than really comfortable and helps me feel like me, I don't think I could still live there. And 10 years into it, it still feels great.
It has been that long now, 10 years.
Yeah.
And where
and
is?
I don't think I'm crazy.
It wouldn't seem to be. The pros would indicate you got a grip on your senses. Where is your tiny house, and how often do you move it?
It's up in Olympia, Washington, and I'm in Portland, Oregon right now. But it's in my friend's backyard, and it's been there pretty much the whole time. I'll pull it out for like Earth Day events or something like that.
All right, much more to talk about to get the details of what it's like. I mean, it's amazing we could get so detailed talking about a space that is essentially 7 feet by 12 feet, but that is the story of the Big Tiny, a built-it-myself memoir by Dee Williams, a proponent of the tiny house movement. We'll talk much more with Dee and take your questions and comments via phone and email when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dee Williams, a fairly well-known proponent of the tiny house movement. She herself lives in a place where the ground floor, she calls it, is 84 square feet. 84 is the correct number. And she's written a book about this called The Big Tiny, a built-it-myself memoir. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about tiny houses and their appeal. 800-838-3760, anywhere you can hear us. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. So the house is one aspect. I mean, have you downsized your life generally just a bit, Dee?
Well, I mean, in order to move into the house, I used to have a big three-bedroom house in Portland, Oregon. And, you know, with all of the appropriate accoutrements, you know, a couch and kitchenwares and closets full of stuff I couldn't remember I owned and a garage full of stuff that I rarely used. So I got rid of almost all of that stuff when I downsized. I farmed out like a couple of things like this really beautiful antique oak dresser that was a wedding gift years before. So I sent that over to a friend's house with the idea that, you know, hey, if this experiment doesn't work, I want that dresser back. And and, you know, other things that kind of got farmed out similarly. But for the most part, it got dragged out to the curb or out over to Goodwill or something like that. And then since then, you know, since I went through the process of getting rid of stuff that I didn't really need or want, I've kind of kept up with that. Every month or so, I'll go through my stuff and figure out what I'm using and what I'm not using and take a bag to Goodwill.
And so you do own Portland Alternative Dwellings. I don't know how much money that makes for you, but, I mean, have you found that the requirements, I mean, the things that you have to do, like earn money, have changed quite a bit because of where you live now?
Oh, yeah, and my money-making job is with the Department of Ecology in Washington State. So I'm a hazardous waste inspector, and I work 24 hours a week for them. And then, you know, Portland Alternative Dwellings is a way for me to continue to get to design little houses and teach workshops and kind of have fun with the little house thing.
Well, you mentioned not having running water in there, and you also mentioned inverters. So you must have batteries and all that other stuff to help you have power. What do you do for when do you shower? I mean, what kind of toilet facility do you have in there?
Well, I have a composting toilet. And then I bring a jug of water in for washing dishes and washing my hands and making tea and stuff like that. And it, you know, water from the kitchen sink drains into a second jar, really big jar that I then use in the garden. So as far as showering goes, I shower at work or I shower at the gym or I shower at my friends' houses. So, you know, it's funny because I was really nervous about this. You know, what I was going to do with the gray water from the shower. So I didn't put a shower in and just, you know, figured I'd figure it out over time. I'd find a way to either have an outdoor shower or, you know, install a shower inside later. And I just kind of figured out a workaround through, you know, work in the gym and friends' houses that it never really became necessary. And That way I didn't have to worry about the head scratcher of what to do with the gray water.
Was there much of a tryout period? Did you do sort of a test run and see what it was like for a couple of weeks or something before you moved into the house permanently?
No, I mean, I kind of jumped in, you know, with both feet. I moved in and I thought I'd try it. I felt like if it was really going to work, I needed to be really in it. And so I sold my big house, and the day that I left my big house, I moved into the little house and moved from Portland to Olympia and, you know, started giving it a go. And, you know, 10 years later, it still feels absolutely wonderful. You know, when I come home and I open the front door, it smells like cedar and knotty pine because of the materials I used, and it still feels like home. So it seems like it's still working. I'm still experimenting, and it's still working.
Let's talk about the last big house, because that was a major project. This is the house in Portland with the three bedrooms. I mean, what kind of shape was it in when you found it?
Oh, it was absolutely the worst house on the block. and here's the strange thing, you know, it's like absolutely the crappiest house on the block, but it took every dime of my savings to get into it, and it still was $250,000 for a mortgage. You know, so it was super expensive and also crappy. So I ended up, you know, investing in how-to books in order to slowly restore the house and repair it. Because I couldn't afford to hire a carpenter. I couldn't afford to hire a plumber or an electrician. So I had friends that did that work. So they would come in and inspect after I finished, you know, my little bit of work. And it worked. The house ended up being absolutely beautiful, and it's still in great shape. I sold it to a friend of mine, and I get to go visit it every once in a while.
Dee Williams, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book, The Big Tiny, A Built-It-Myself Memoir, about her time in a tiny house. So you growing up on a farm, I'm sure you had some mechanical skills and ability to fix things. But, I mean, how much of an education was it to do things like the plumbing and the wiring and the carpentry on that house in Portland?
Oh, it's huge. It was really huge, and mistakes were made, you know. I kind of have this motto, and I don't know if this is growing up with brothers where, you know, every other day one of us was saying, hey, watch this. And, you know, we were problematic children, would be what my mother would say. But, you know, I kind of had a one part how to, two parts why not attitude while I was working on my old house, and that really helped me get over my fear of making mistakes and gave me a chance to redo things when I didn't do it the right way the first time. And so I think that translated really well into starting the Little House Project. I had a background in architectural engineering, so the engineering of, you know, this stick-built structure on top of a utility trailer was really interesting and fun for me to take on. And so there was some engineering involved in figuring out how to make that work well and safely. And then, you know, as far as figuring out how to build a little house, there was a steep learning curve on it. I mean, just picking up a sheet of plywood was hard for me. You know, I weigh 115 pounds, so picking up a 60-pound sheet of plywood was hard. But over time, you know, you develop muscle memory, and you figure out your way around a table saw, and you end up, for me, I feel really lucky because I was able to create something really beautiful.
The part of this, though, came from some things going on in your life generally. I mean, you had the big house in Portland, but you were still spending the week in Olympia. Is that right?
Well, I was working part-time actually I was working full-time, but part of that job required me to be up in Olympia a couple of days a week. So I was on the road a lot, and you know, I wanted to work full-time. I was, you know, building my career. And, you know, when I wasn't working to pay my mortgage, I was working on the house itself, either mowing the grass or fixing the roof or, you know, throwing myself at some project, like, you know, trying to get the garage to quit leaning into my neighbor's yard quite so fully. So, you know, I was running kind of 900 miles an hour all the time.
And that schedule would have taken a lot out of anyone, and that level of commitment to the house certainly. But what was the first clear indication that you were more than just getting tired?
Well, I ended up passing out at the grocery store, and I woke up a couple of days later in the ICU in the hospital, and I had had a heart attack and was diagnosed with congestive heart failure. And I am a very athletic, or used to be an athletic person, and I had no kind of lead up to that experience. It really hit me out of the blue. And it was really awkward because I was trying to marry this information that I was getting from my cardiologist and other doctors that I was sick and needed to take it easy with how I viewed myself and how I felt. I felt pretty good, even though I had this heart muscle disease. And I remember coming home from the hospital feeling just completely, you know, lost in my big house and not sure, you know, how to kind of continue on with my normal life.
That really is a slap upside the head. You think you're one kind of person and your body says, oh, wait, you've got this going on too.
Yeah, you know, and I've talked to a lot of other people who have had similar health scares. And, you know, the diagnosis for my cardiomyopathy was 1 to 5 years with my heart. And maybe I could get a heart transplant or they have, you know, assist devices that can carry you over until you get a transplant, or you just pass away. And the idea of dying wasn't the thing that scared me so much. It was lingering, you know, ending up in my friend's living room or in the hospital, you know, very, very sick and unable to care for myself anymore. And that just, you know, it's funny because looking back on it, I was more afraid of having to lean into my friends like that than I was of actually just kicking the bucket. Hmm. And I feel a little different now.
You know, didn't like to be a burden to people. We're talking to Dee Williams about the changes in her life that led her to adopting a much smaller footprint in life. She lives in a tiny house, 7 by 12 feet. Her book is called The Big Tiny, a built-it-myself memoir. You can join us with your comments and questions here on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll talk much more about the mechanics of tiny houses in the moments ahead. Join us at 800-838-3760, anywhere you can hear us. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. So what eventually stabilized your heart condition?
You know, I think it was good, clean living. you know, I read an article about a guy who had built a little house while I was sitting in my doctor's office. And there was something about this little house that just seemed to click for me. It seemed to make sense. Like if I could get out from under my mortgage, maybe I could work part-time and have time to go play with my friends or do whatever I wanted. If I could get out from under, you know, my house chores, maybe I could, you know, volunteer my time and be the kind, generous person I always thought I would be when I wasn't so busy. So I think being able to step into a little bit more of my dream life of spending my time the way I want to spend it has been really healthy for my heart. I've certainly slowed down a lot as far as my job goes. I only work, you know, like I said before, 24 hours a week. And that gives me lots of elbow room to have fun and do the other stuff that I like to do.
You actually saw the picture of the tiny house man, Jay Schaefer, in a magazine at the doctor's office. Is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Was it one of those moments in the movie where they pull the camera back and zoom in at the same time?
Yes, exactly. I think I pulled the magazine up close to examine his arms, you know, like, God, you know, anybody who builds a house, they must be burly. But, you know, Jay isn't. He's a normal-sized, normal guy. And so it was like, wow, if a normal-sized, normal guy could do it, maybe a normal-sized, normal woman could do it, too.
And so this is Jay Schaefer. You called him in Iowa City. What did he say?
Well, he was awesome, and he's very funny. So I can't actually even remember the conversation other than he laughed a lot. He told me about his house. And then my brother, one of my brothers, lived in Iowa City where he lived. So I made a plan to come visit my brother and his family and at the same time swing by and see Jay and see his house. So I flew to Iowa City and had this opportunity to walk around Jay's house. And I remember feeling like I was standing next to the president. I was so in awe of this little house and of Jay, and it was beautiful. His house was just gorgeous. And totally inspired me to try it, to see if I could build a little house. And he sold me some plans, and I reworked those plans to fit my body and to fit my needs and wants. You know, the plans that he sold me weren't quite what I wanted. But it sure gave me all of the information I needed in order to feel like I could do it, you know.
Did your brother Doug fully understand what you were contemplating?
I think he did. You know, my brothers and my sister are of the same ilk in that, you know, any other week, one of us will call the other and say, oh, I've decided to run for governor, or, oh, hey, I've decided to go skydiving, or, you know, we seem to be doing a lot of odd things a lot of the time. So they didn't make me sound or feel crazy. They were my parachute if things went poorly.
And in fact, you and Doug had visited Guatemala together just the year before you visited Jay Schaefer and looked at the tiny house. What was the impression that Guatemala made on you? This kind of factors into the story.
Oh, yeah, it was actually huge. You know, we went down there to help build a school. And, you know, I had done work with, you know, at a soup kitchen, and I had built houses in Mexico before. But this was the first time I had really kind of had an opportunity as a homeowner and as a person kind of in full stride with their career and having a lot of stuff that I got to deal with a cycle of poverty. You know, these are people that are poor that don't necessarily have an opportunity or ever will have an opportunity to get out of that cycle of poverty. And they were kind, generous, awesome people who seemed to, you know, take in stride this rich white lady, and it really humbled me. It really helped me understand my privilege. And when I got home from that trip, again, it was like all of the stuff in my house just made absolutely no sense. I just purchased a new dishwasher for $400, and that $400 could have, you know, built a new well in a little village where we were working. So Doug and I both, and my niece. Nieces who were on that trip too were very humbled by that trip, and it was a really good eye-opener for all of us.
Dee Williams, you mentioned just a moment ago about taking, though, the plans that Jay Schaefer had and modifying them to fit you or to fit your body. I mean, it almost sounds like tailoring a suit.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, it's that's the cool thing about building your own house, besides the fun of learning how to be a carpenter. You know, it's like you get to create something that really is tailored to your wants and needs, to your body. So instead of making the kitchen counters, you know, 34 inches high or 36 inches high, or, you know, however they're normally built, you can make them 28 inches tall because that's where your waist hits. Or the first piece of furniture I made for my little house is this little three-legged stool. And I sat on a piece of wood, and I drew a circle, a semicircle around my butt, and that became the chair seat, you know? So it was really fun to make things to fit my body. And they're accommodating enough for most of my friends, too. You know, like I set the joist height for the loft at 6'3", because my tallest friend is 6'3".
Ah, so just scrapes his hair on the overhead
stuff. He ducks anyway. Mm-hmm. He's so used to ducking all the time, he still ducks.
So talk about the process of planning and building and some of the key choices you made in addition to what you just talked about as you got started.
Well, I you know, in the workshops that we teach at PAD, you know, one of the things that I really encourage people to do is to play anthropologist with themselves. So, you know, take a moment to examine how much space you really need to make a sandwich and how many burners on your stovetop do you actually use. And so those kinds of things for me led me to, you know, I have one burner. And that's because that's all I've ever used in real life. You know, when I was in my big house, I hardly ever used the oven, so I don't have an oven. My refrigerator was full of mostly of condiments, you know, and then I would buy fresh produce for, you know, salads and soups and stuff like that, but use it kind of quickly. So I figured a very small efficiency refrigerator would be plenty big for me. And sadly, I measured wrong when I was building the kitchen cabinet, so it didn't actually fit inside the kitchen cabinetry the way that it was supposed to. So I never installed the refrigerator, and I've been using a blue cooler for the last 10 years, and it works out fine because, you know, beer and half, what more do you need?
Right. All right, we'll talk more about some of the corners you've had to cut or some of the compromises you've had to make to be able to live in the tiny house. The book is called The Big Tiny, a Built It Myself memoir. It's by Dee Williams. She's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and take your phone calls and emails. If you'd like to make some comments or questions, join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we return in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about tiny houses. Today's guest actually lives in one of those and wrote a book about it. Her book is called The Big Tiny, a Built It Myself memoir. Dee Williams is the author. She is the co-owner of Portland Alternative Dwellings, so she teaches other people how to make similar houses. And you can join our discussion on the exchange at 800-838-3760 region-wide in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You were just talking about not being able to fit the refrigerator, so you keep the blue cooler, and as long as you got beer in half and half, you're all set. But obviously the tiny house lifestyle implies a certain level of planning that I think the rest of us aren't used to. I mean, you have to plan things like when to take showers, and you have to make some other compromises here and there, don't you, Dee?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, those are the things that I tried to forecast as best I could while I was in the planning phase. And I nailed it pretty much about 85% of the time. I'm perfectly happy with everything I did. You know, as an example, I really sized my, I have a big, giant solar electric system that I sized based on what I thought my electrical demand would be. And it was really sized around my old habits. So having a coffee grinder and, you know, coffee maker and, you know, some electric gadgets that I just never actually used in my little house. So I generate way more electricity than I need. So I wish I had been able to kind of imagine myself, you know, what do they say, eat your conservation veggies before you, go for your solar cookies. So I just hadn't really done a very good job of kind of buttoning things up before I invested in that big expensive system. And the same with, you know, walking over to use the neighbor's shower or showering at work. It's taken a little bit of, it's a hassle sometimes. I want to be able to shower at 11 o'clock at night and I can't unless I walk up to the gym, which is, you know, doable. But who really likes showering at the gym? Really? I don't know of anybody who really like, ooh, cool, I'm going to go to the gym and shower. You know, we all want our own personal shower. But, you know, those moments of kvetching, those moments of feeling really frustrated with the fact that I don't have everything I want at my fingertips, it really sounds cheesy, but it really does invite an opportunity to kind of, you know, well, I got a lot more than my friends in Guatemala have. I've got a lot more than most of the planet's population. I got a lot more than the folks that I serve food to down at the food bank, you know. So it really does invite an opportunity to kind of rest on the fact that I have plenty and it's enough. And so I've been tying myself over with that logic for a little while, and that doesn't mean I don't complain sometimes or am marginally miserable sometimes with my choices, but I get over it, you know. I have a chance to get over it.
But you did mention being perfectly happy 85% of the time. Sounds like happiness, though, has been completely redesigned or redefined in your life.
Yeah, I think it has. I mean, I think the basic things in my life are very much the same. I have essentially the same job. I just do it less often. I have the same friends. They haven't ostracized me for being a nutball. you know, my habits and my routines are really so similar to my old big house. The only thing that's changed is kind of the work around not having as much space. So I go to the library more often. I go to the food co-op more often. There are these chores that are different, but the habits are the same. And, you know, being happy 85% of the time, a good solid B average is, I feel good about that, you know? And it's been really nice to kind of be invited to enjoy, you know, the weather and enjoy my friends in a different space and a different speed, I guess. And I do think that's worked its magic on me.
Well, the part about enjoying your friends, though, I mean, this is not like a space in which you can entertain lavishly or have large dinner parties or anything. But, I mean, you mentioned your 6'3" friends, so you obviously do have some people over. How cramped does it get? How many people can you fit in there at one? How many people have you fit? Have you ever tried to do it like a phone booth stuffing at college in the 60s?
We have. We've done it a bunch of times. I think the largest number was 64 fourth graders. So granted, they weren't adult-sized, but they were pretty big, and we were able to get 64 kids in. I think we had 17 kids in the loft. To this day, I don't know why their teachers let me do this, but we just crammed as many. They were standing on the toilet and on the kitchen counter and, just shoved in there like a human jar of pickles. And, I'm about ready to yell, see, you don't need that much space. We all fit just perfectly fine. When one of the guys, cut the cheese, as my brother would say, and it was like rats leaving a ship. They couldn't get out of that house fast enough. We all collapsed on the lawn, fake coughing, and it was hilarious. And it's funny because those kids are in, I think they're in like ninth grade now, and it's really cool when I see them. And we have this little secret handshake thing that we do, which is the fake cough and roll our eyes.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So did that mean when they see you, it's like, hey, look, it's Little House Lady?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's very fun.
You mentioned being into the house in Portland, your last big house, the three-bedroom place, the wreck, for $250,000 just on the mortgage. We haven't talked yet about the amount of money that you shelled out for first the trailer, which I guess was a pretty significant buy in and of itself, I'm thinking. But then the process of moving on from there, how much total did it take to build your tiny house?
It was $10,000 all told, and that included, the trailer was expensive. The solar electric system was almost a quarter of the whole cost. And then the windows were very expensive. They're low-E argon insulated windows, and I wanted these expensive windows in part because of energy efficiency, but also because of noise. I wasn't sure where I was going to be parked, so I really wanted to be able to kind of control the noise. And that, just those three things, the trailer, the windows, and the PV system, the solar electric system, was almost $5,000. So the rest of the sticks and the roofing and the sheeting and everything else that went into it was $5,000.
And, what regulations actually cover this? I mean, this thing is on wheels, so I suppose in some context it's a travel trailer, but then obviously it's a stick-built house. So, I mean, did you have to build, you didn't have to do 2x6 walls, I'm thinking, but I really don't know.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is a lot of what we talk about in our workshops at TAD. That engineering is, we can follow the kind of general building code for earthquake zones and hurricane zones. Because if you think about it, moving a stick structure on the highway is like taking it into a hurricane. 90-mile-an-hour winds, these really weird shears, wind shears that you get, big bumps. So we followed the international building code with these big, giant tension ties in the corners that tie into the walls. And then the floor itself is bolted into the trailer. It's kind of nested inside this metal trailer. So it works as one unit. And then the Department of Transportation regulates how big something can be and still kind of legally get on the highway. So we built it to the DOT restrictions as well. So there were a bunch of different kind of codes that applied to making this thing safe and structurally sound.
And were there things that obviously you had to go to a couple of different places to find out how to build this thing, but I mean, just surprises that you ran across in terms of the construction itself and things that you could get away with on building a house that you couldn't get away with on building this thing atop a trailer?
Not really. I mean, the way that the little house is built, it really follows the building code. So, I mean, the exception is the thickness of the walls, like 2x6s, it creates this 5.5-inch cavity for insulation, and I only use 2x4s. Structurally, that's perfectly fine. I just have less insulation in the walls, which in a small space, it's pretty easy to heat, so it wasn't as mandatory for me.
So you mentioned spending about a quarter of the $10,000 just on the PV system. How much do you spend on utilities then? Because you're obviously getting most of your stuff from the sun electrically. Do you ever have to attach to shore power? Do you ever run an extension cord to the neighbor's house?
Yeah, I'll use an extension cord if I'm going to pull a big vacuum in, and which has a really big surge charge on it. So my little solar electric system can't handle that big surge. So I'll use an extension cord if I'm going to run something like that. But otherwise, no, the sun keeps up with my utility just perfectly fine. And then I have a propane heater that I use sparingly in the winter, and a propane cook stove. So all I have to pay for is the propane, which is about $8 a month in the wintertime.
And do you pay anything to the friends whose yard you parked in?
You know, I just started doing that. I didn't for years because I was caretaking. So my friends live in one house, and my friend's Aunt Rita, who was 80 years old when I moved into the backyard, she's paralyzed on her left side, and I was caretaking her, and she passed away last year. So when she passed away and I wasn't able to kind of earn my keep by supporting Rita, I started paying rent.
There's been a whole demand. I mean, when you talk about things like supporting Rita and going to the library a lot, I mean, this is just a whole different dimension to your life than you would have had if you were working a 40-hour week in the standard no-wheels house.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's funny because I didn't really plan on these incidental, you know, wonderful relationships that I would develop. I really was looking at having free time to hang out with my friends and visit my family and, you know, go for a walk for, you know, I wanted to hike for as long as my heart would let me and be in my body as much and, as you know, just burn it up, you know, really go for it for as long as I could. And I hadn't really taken into account that I would fall in love with the people that bring fresh produce into the food co-op, you know, because I don't want them just to do a good job. I want them to thrive. You know, they're my pantry. They're my refrigerator. And the same goes with Rita. You know, I had Thanksgiving dinner and Christmas dinners with her in the past, but I had no idea that I would so appreciate and love hanging out with somebody who knows every word to fly me to the moon, you know, and she ended up being a really good support for me when I was sick. You know, she, you know, let me sleep in her house if I was sick and needed somebody to be within shouting distance. And it was a really wonderful exchange. And, you know, when she passed, it was, I think, the biggest loss I've ever had. And it was a hard year this last year dealing with her passing.
I'm sorry to hear you've been through that. One of the things that we haven't really talked about, though, is this is a space for one. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, are there people you know through your work with PAD, Portland Alternative Dwellings, who are having two to a tiny house?
Oh yeah, there are two. There are families. There are lots of people doing it, and you know, I think the challenge is that, you know, like my friends Tammy and Logan, they live right outside Wairika, and they built their house with both of them in mind. So they tailored it to fit the two of them. And so going from a house that's really tailored around my wants and needs, my body, to including somebody else, they would have to be an awful lot like me. You know, and my track record for attracting people, it's that they're usually opposites. So I think I would probably struggle living with somebody else in my little house. But that doesn't mean we couldn't design and build something that would fit the two of us.
So we talked about the construction stuff and having to deal with DOT regulations in addition to building codes and things. Now, what about zoning? I mean, do you ever run into issues in Olympia where somebody said they're going to ticket you if you don't get that thing off the property or anything?
Well, they have, you know, it's funny the way that the building code works, or the zoning code inside the residential code works, is if you build it on the land, you know, there are all of these restrictions on size, placement, stuff like that, utilities. And if you build it on wheels, you enter into the residential code in something called the maintenance code. And it applies to things that you have on wheels, like RVs, trailers, tractors, stuff like that. And in those cases, they have restrictions on where you can put it on your property. So you can't park it in the front yard. You can't park it right up against the alley or something like that. So, you know, I've been really lucky talking with the folks from the City of Olympia about, you know, what their concerns are, if they have any concerns. And, you know, we've been able to sort through that.
So what would you say are some of the major cautions you'd give to people thinking about going into this, or the major selling points you'd offer to them?
Well, it's funny because I feel like I'm plugging our workshops, but we really dial into those considerations. I would really caution people to take a look at what the local zoning restrictions are and talk to their city or county planning people to find out what's permissible, and also find out what's appropriate for weather, you know, as far as, you know, looking at the moisture control and ventilation and what the common building practices are in the area. And then looking at your finances and making sure that this is a bite you want to take out of your savings, or however you're going to pay for it or put it on a credit card. So those are the cautions. The benefits are, I really do think that it allows you to live your life the way you want to.
All right, so much in the book, and it's a fun read as well. The Big Tiny, A Built It Myself Memoir. Dee Williams wrote it and joined us today on The Exchange. Dee, thanks so much for your hour.
Oh, thank you so much. I love this show.
All right, take care. Tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about some high schools in the region that ranked highly in a national survey of high schools. We'll talk about the differential approaches to child welfare in the state of Oregon. And then at 9 o'clock, we'll talk to the author of a book about mental illness and dealing with it. The book is called Sherry Goes Sane. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duren. Today's engineer, student assistant Reed Newland. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Please join us again tomorrow at 8 for another edition of the Jefferson Exchange here on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. And have a great day.